Welcome to the Food and Farming podcast from AHDB, keeping levy payers informed and at the heart of the conversation.
Milking cows and dry cows have very different requirements from their diet. What might be high quality silage for one animal is another's poison. As forage makes up the major part of a cow's ration, it's vital that silages are made with the end use in mind and targeted to the dietary requirements of the group. Planning a silage strategy starts well before the mower comes out of the shed. Sward type, slurry and fertiliser applications, and timing of mowing are all vital in producing optimum silage quality that meets the requirements of the specific stock on your farm. AHDB's Senior Knowledge Exchange Manager, David Ball, spoke with Matt Jackson from Penlech Back in Wales, one of our strategic farms, and Dave Davis from Silage Solutions to find out how the two of them have been working together to ensure Matt is optimising his forage quality for his dry cows.
Morning, Matt. Thanks for joining us this morning. Could you tell us a little bit about the background to your farm and your farming system, and also what your silage requirements are?
Yeah, we're basically milking 300 crossbred cows here. They're about 480 kilos live weight, 470, 480. We're on 100 hectares of ground. We're running at about 3 stocking rate, which is the lowest we've ever run at since we started here. We're on our 8th season, going 9th season this year. And I suppose I've been going for a little bit less is more in making sure that we've not got reels up and we're not restricting cows with reels. We're doing more like 24-hour breaks in whole paddock. That's where we're at the minute.
And what about when you're planning for your silage? What do you need by way of silage? And how do you go about ensuring you get the right quantity and the right quality?
Well, we're typically using about between 1.3 and 1.5 tonnes per cow per year, dry matter, depending on quality and depending on the season that comes. So that's what I normally typically put it on. We are clamping all silage, or the majority of silage. A little bit of bales come in from off-laying ground, and we close like 60 to 70 acres of the farm once we're after our first and second rotation. So it gets grazed twice, and then on from that, it's closed for silage for 3 cuts.
I would guess so from your system that most of your silage requirement will be for dry cows, but you'll also have a requirement for milking cow silage. Is that right?
Yeah, so we've got 2 pits. We had 1 pit and we've split it with walls in the middle, and these L-like walls deliberately so we can actually have good quality silage for sort of November to December up to dry off. And then we use a few of the bales and the back end as well. And then the other half of the small clamp we use in the spring. And then, well, the cows are going out to grass and back and forth. But the majority, say 300 to 350 tonnes, would be dry cow, sort of 10 ME type grass, stemmy stuff, high fibre stuff, which keeps, basically, we put a condition on cows, but it won't make them too fat, if you like. That's always a job here, because I like feeding cows.
Good, thanks, Matt. So if we move to Dave, could you highlight, Dave, some of the key points which Matt ought to be aware of when he's planning for his silage season?
I really liked what Matt said, that he's come to the conclusion less can be more. And I really do wish some more farmers that would think that sometimes less cows is more milk. And, you know, I think the key things are, actually, he said he also liked to feed cows. And it is very important that we have 2 types of silage on the vast majority of farms, one being that high quality, where we should be pushing the 12 and a half ME, 16% crude protein for the milking cows. And I suppose that's more important in the spring when they're fresh calvers, that we don't pull back on that silage quality for those fresh calvers, even if they are grazing, because that will have a detrimental effect on the peak milk yield and you'll never get it back up. But it is also important in the back end, like Matt's trying to do there. And, you know, again, I commend him for splitting that clamp, because that's the only way you can really manage these different types of silage. But I think a key point is that not enough farmers are thinking about their dry cow silage. In a lot of countries, grass silage is seen as a poison for dry cows, but actually in the UK, it is a necessary requirement. And our ME of 10 ME, so stemmy, actually seed head silage, is a key target. I would be recommending that it's actually not cut late in the season, because there the potassium concentration tends to be higher in the later cut silages. So it should be an earlier season cut silage to try and reduce that potassium content and reduce the risks of issues around calving. But the other key point is that it needs to be, and this is where I hate the comment, it's poor quality, it's poor nutritional value, but it's hygienically very good. So we want that silage to have low ME. Like I said, 10 ME should be our target, protein around 10 to 12, but it should be absolutely spot on in terms of fermentation, no mold or aerobic spoilage visible, because when we have that mold creeping in, that's when we get the risks of poorer intake. If it's not cracking hygienic quality, we don't get the intakes, and that dry cow, really, we want high intakes of poor nutritive value silage to get that rumen working well, get a good rumen turnover with that forage so that we can maximize forage utilization in early lactation, so that rumen is really working. And if we have molds there, we have the risk of mycotoxins, which then reduce that quality in terms of intake, but also can cause other health issues around calving, which we don't want. And that's the challenge, is getting that low nutritive value but not poor preservation quality. And ideally, we also want it to be a bit drier with a bit of a longer chop. So bringing the bales into that scenario, which possibly Matt isn't doing, because probably those bales are of high quality coming from away, is a way of getting around that.
Okay, thank you, Dave. You mentioned the potassium levels there, and trying not to get into a situation where they're at high levels in the grass silage. That will have an impact, won't it, on the fertilizer program that the grass gets. Can you give us a little bit of a few tips on how to ensure that the potassium levels are where they need to be?
So this is going to be a very big ask this year because of the price of fertilizer nitrogen being through the roof. Obviously, farmers are going to want to maximize, rightly so, the use of farm waste, slurries and manures, but they are a source of high potassium because there's a big potassium level in those types of wastes. And so my recommendation for your dry cow silage is not to add farm waste, to add just bag nitrogen and cut all potassium out of that. Now, agronomists say, well, the plant needs potassium, and that's right, but the cow doesn't need potassium. And so if we over egg that potassium in our fertilizer regime, we end up having problems, or we need to overcome problems by the addition of other things in the ration to enable the cow to be managing that potassium. So ideally, no farm waste. The idea would be an 8-week regrowth, which actually does reduce your mineral content in your grasses. So with an 8-week regrowth, we do have less minerals because they're diluted by that bulk of growth in the last 2 or 3 weeks in the field. But ideally, like I said, low levels of slurry or manure application, maybe dirty water from the farm rather than slurries off the farm. So that's one way you can manage some of that. But it is a challenge this year. It's going to be a big challenge because, you know, nitrogen is expensive and slurry and farm wastes are a source you have readily available on farm. The other thing is that if you cut later, there's potassium uptake late summer, early autumn, much more potassium uptake into grass. So the earlier you can cut that dry cow silage from the earlier cuts, the better. But still keeping that 8-week regrowth, which again is a challenge in a grazed grass milk production system, because you don't want to knock back your grass growth so much. And by leaving it for 8 weeks, you do tend to knock, well, you will knock grass growth back, recovery times back.
Thanks, Dave. I wonder whether you could just remind us about why it is important to keep the potassium levels under control, particularly for dry cow silage.
Potassium is an issue, and if you look at the mineral contents, the potassium requirements, and I think I'm right in this, is about 1.5% in your silage, and most silages in the UK are running about 3%, and it causes problems around calving that mean that your vet bill goes up and you have more issues around calving, so you end up with significant problems, or you can have significant problems with that high potassium, and that just means that the whole system's not working efficiently. You end up compromising their milk yields going into the next lactation, and it's one of the key targets. Obviously, there are ways you can get around that by additions of certain other feed ingredients, but if we can, reducing that potassium, and, you know, potassium's a cost in the system if we're applying it in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Thanks. And there's a tendency, of course, over a number of years to have applied farmyard manures to fields year after year. And there's a potential, therefore, for potassium levels in the soil to be reasonably high in fields that are being harvested for silage. And Matt, I know you take some soil samples. You've got a record of your soil samples and potassium levels. Is this something that you're able to bring into your fertilizer planning to ensure that you meet the requirements of the resultant silage?
Yeah, well, typically on the platform, we're trying our best to keep the P's and K's as high as possible with cows grazing. And that's where it becomes quite difficult because of that. I'm applying a lot of dirty water, essentially, on a weekly basis as we're grazing paddocks. But a lot of the silage ground is bought from far away, so we might not necessarily have the exact soil samples on that silage ground. So I've always been inclined to go with something like 20-10-10, a light watery slurry application or dirty water. We can't exactly pump really thick slurry far anyway. We've tried that before and it's too thick for the contractor because it's the distance pumping. So I tend to put a very watery application followed by about 2 weeks later with a 20-10-10. And in a way, that's just to ensure that we're not taking too much from that ground because we don't know enough about it. That's the difficulty. And that's why I wanted to go down this route of 3 cows a hectare and try and simplify our silage management on farm. So my idea is to try and get the best quality silage for the milking off the platform as early as possible and then get one big cut from all the other ground that's supported. So at the moment, that's exactly what's happened this year. I've put a light application on the off-lying ground of dirty water and I've followed it this year with nitrogen only. But I see a huge difference in the growth rates to what I normally get already. And it maybe that's a seasonal thing and it's been dry. But typically the 20-10-10 seems to work really well for me to get that big crop at the end. And because it's off-lying ground and it's farmed differently, to get the crops and to make it viable, that's the route I've been going down. I'm more concerned on the home farm that I'm taking too much off the grazing platform. And I'm, like David was saying before, I'm restricting growth on the other side of the platform.
Would you like to come back on that, Dave?
I would. I think you made some very valid points there, Matt. I'm not being critical, but you've given me one typical farmer response to advice, which is, this is what I do because I get a good yield. And I think you could cut back on that potassium on your away ground without any detrimental effect, because you're probably running at very good P and K values on those farms. And the problem with potassium is hypercalcemia, milk fever and retained placentas. And it's very well known, if we can reduce the potassium level in that 6 week dry cow period, we will have a lot less of those issues. You know, a lot of farmers forget the dry cow is the most important cow on the farm. Because you mess her diet up and you mess up the next lactation, you mess up getting her back in calf on time, which in a grazing platform is actually more critical than somebody that's housed all year round, because you want that cow to be calving down to make maximum use of that fresh grass. So I do think you can pull back on that potassium fertilizer without any detrimental effect to your yields. Obviously, you can come back at me in a bit of time and say, well, actually, I found that I did have a detrimental effect on yield. And you're right, this year has been a challenge for the growing season. At the moment, I think it's more of a challenge than the last 2 or 3 years, but hopefully we will see an improvement in that growth and the weather in terms of grass growing.
And I know you've got some soil sample results, Matt. Have you studied those for the ground where you're getting your dry cow silage from? And are they at high levels of potassium or medium or whatever? Is it something that you can work on to say, well, okay, they are at high levels, so I can hold back on my fertilizer and my slurry? Or are they at low levels where they perhaps need that input?
They're most certainly at low levels. There's not a lot of fert being put on from other people. I think it's highly reliant on what I put onto it as regards to what the person gets out of it after I've left.
Yeah, so this is not land that you've farmed for a long time, is it, Matt? This is land that you've taken hold of recently, so perhaps don't know the history of it. So you're relying on a soil analysis to tell you what's in the soil.
Yeah, but we only farm it for the 12 to 18 week silage period. We pay per acre per cut. So
we are not in control for the other sort of 8 or 9 months of the year. And this is one of the reasons why I wanted to go away from that a little bit and try and get more control of what we're doing, because I think by default, we just all become takers because we're so desperate for that feed. We just end up taking anything that comes available on the market, regardless whether it's long-term, short-term. And I was just sick of trying to spend a lot of money on somebody else's ground to try and get very little out of it. And that's what happened with the high stocking rate, basically. I just became a taker. And the quality of feed we were getting and the amount of fertilizer we were putting on just wasn't viable, really, and wasn't sustainable. So that's why we're doing what we're doing on the grazing platform here. I just wonder whether I should be running a higher cover at the back end. It's a bit of a catch-22, because the back end last year, we had a really nice dry back end. We were still milking into December on the grass, and I was like, this is amazing. But then you come to measure grass in the spring, and you think, ooh, I've hit it hard at the back, so I've not got as much to start with. And that hits the silage when you can close your silage and everything else, because you haven't got that bank of grass that we would have normally had. So maybe that's something that I need to adjust to make sure that we can close those silage paddocks off as early as possible. I mean, Dave, when should we be closing for the first cut? And also, if we've got offlying ground and it's had silage taken off it, say the beginning of October, and nothing else has been on it, should we be trying to graze it with something or through the winter, i.e. sheep or young stock? Or what's the effects of grazing it off to get it to, so it's fresh, and then applying fertilizer or slurry, versus not doing anything and you've got sort of a bit of a dormant sort of 6 to 8, 10 inches of grass? Do you know what I mean? Do you get what I'm saying?
I get exactly what you're saying. I think there is an issue with leaving an aftermath over the autumn winter period. It does reduce the spring growth, and it also reduces the quality of that spring growth, because you've got dead material in there, which will reduce your D value and your ME. And you'll also increase your risks of aerobic spoilage and mycotoxins because you've got a dead thatch. So ideally, and again, this is something that takes some management, because obviously each year is different and how much growth you get over that autumn period can vary greatly. But grazing it off to get a clean regrowth right at the start of the season is good. And I ideally would be grazing it up until New Year's Day and then letting that new growth, fresh growth, take from there. And that gives you the ability to have an early cut or a late early cut if you make that for dry cow silage. The misinformation in the, it's less so now, but you know, 20 years ago you used to say that you shouldn't graze anything because it reduces your silage quality. It doesn't. You'll increase your silage quality by having a clean sward when you start the season. What you do is actually reduce your yield available for silage. And I'm very specific on that, because if you're getting that income, if you're grazing a stock that's on your farm that needs feeding, then it's a valuable use of that grazed grass. If you're bringing in tack sheep, I think a calculation needs to be done on how much you're being paid per head for that tack sheep and how much of that good quality grass they're eating, if you're eating it in the current year, so from January the 1st onwards. And that's the thing that you need to be looking at. It's forage quantity versus quality and where that forage is going, whether it's going to some of your stock that's valuable or whether it's being taken by another farmer's stock that's possibly not paying enough per head for that forage quality. And then the other part of that picture is by grazing it after January, you will reduce your yield available for silage. So it depends on how much silage stocks you need in terms of both milking cow and dry cow silage. So those are the things that, you know, I look at. But in terms of quality, the only thing you're losing, you're not losing anything in quality. That's about cutting time relative to when you've taken sheep off, grazing animals off, or you've shut the field. That's where your quality comes in, and your quantity on that won't change. It's just the time of the year if you've grazed some of that forage beforehand. So those are the things to be looking at within that and costing them properly.
So would it work the same, say you've got 6, 8 to 10 inches of grass on the 10th of February on that offline ground because you've cut it in October? It's then been growing, or if you've got a warm season, we tend to grow grass all the way through here, then getting it off you know, mid to end of February? And would it work the same as grazing it off, just cutting it, baling it, getting it out of the way, and then it just gives that freshness to the grass ready to start again?
That does work, yes. The quality of that grass could be questionable, so it's about getting it analysed. If you're baling it, there's less of an issue because you're doing that rapidly. You've always got a challenge getting a good wilt on something in February. I hope that still holds true because we don't want global warming to go that far. But, you know, that's your challenge, what you will feed that to. But there will be stock on the farm where it won't be detrimental. You know, your young growing stock, that's perfectly adequate silage, and it's about getting it analysed. The only problem with that February cut silage is getting a fermentation from it, because the sugars will be low, the proteins can be quite high. It is worth having an additive, and it probably won't smell, in my experience, it doesn't smell sweet like silage, but it doesn't smell horrible like a butyric fermentation. But yeah, there's more farmers taking that sort of grass off, and it does work.
So Matt, you've obviously got an added complication with this off-lying land because of the period of time under which you've got control of it, and somebody else has control of it the rest of the time. So as far as you planning your silage quality from there, you can perhaps rein back on the P's and K's if there's sufficient in the soil indexes, and just apply nitrogen or your dirty water in order to get the yield that you need. But of course, you may not have control over what other people are putting on that land. And so there could be a situation where you end up with high potassiums because of what somebody else has done.
100%, and that's what happens. You know, there's muck being spread on there and stuff like that, and, you know, dry manure, whatever. So it's a bit of a difficult one. What I've been doing, because we've been short silage ground this year in particular, and well, last year as well, was buying some hay. What's your thoughts on that, Dave, as regards to what we should be looking at? Is there certain standout quality, or what the level of dry matter is in it? Well, typically, we always go by price.
I think on your hays, if it's for dry cows, which I suspect it is, you need to be looking at the quality in terms of fibre content. So seed heads is a good thing in dry cow hay. And the most important thing is, on top of that, is whether it smells musty, whether it's dusty. Those two things should be avoided. And if it's green, that's even better. But it's more things you can look at than get an analysis. It should be free from mold, but it's the mustiness. You know, if you can smell mustiness in it, it's not a good thing. So your price is important, but don't get poor hygienic quality based on price. It still has got to be a nice clean, you know, when you open the bale up, there should be not large amounts of free dust flying about, because that dust is sort of associated with the growth of molds. And the problem with hay is that obviously it's a mature crop when it's cut, so it's actually got a higher potential risk factor for these molds and mycotoxins. And I do want to talk about risk factors, because there's a lot of people making on the back of farmers on mycotoxins, etc. Grass is generally a lower mycotoxin problem crop than some of the other crops we have on farm, like maize and whole crop cereals. But your hay is at that end where it's likely to be more of a risk, as is your dry cow silage, because of the stage of growth you're cutting it at. But yeah, it's about how it looks and how it smells and how it feels in terms of that fibre content. So you've got a good fibre content. In terms of the dry matter, any hay should be above 85% dry matter, ideally up to 90%, so that you've got a very low risk of mould growth during storage.
And does storing hay, Dave, does it affect its quality over a period of time?
It will do, but again, that depends on how well it was made and how dry you're storing it. So if you've got some very dense bales that were made very well, they were dry when they were made, and you're storing them in a damp-free environment, then the quality will drop very slowly. It's not a major problem. The bigger problem comes when when the water content was down at 20% or 80% dry matter, and then you've got microbial growth in there the whole time you're storing it, or you've got a leaky shed roof where it's getting damp in the middle That's causing your issues. So the quality will change a little bit. It's like a well-made silage. The quality does drop, but if it's well-made and you keep the rules, then quality shouldn't change that much.
I was going to mention straw. I'm not sure whether it's a dirty word in your part of the world, Matt, but Dave, would that be an option to feed straw to dry cows?
It is an option, obviously. I think straw should be a dirty word in the west of Wales. And I think we should be trying if we can. And again, this is a challenge for Matt because he's short of land. So yeah, Matt's at the type of place where straw would fit. But again, straw's not cheap and God knows what it might cost this year. So, you know, I think it's looking at the options, and straw is a good option. But again, it depends on where your dry cows are in terms of their condition score when you dry them off versus where they need to be when you carve them down. And obviously, we don't want to change condition score much over that dry cow period. So yes, if they're looking well, and it sounds like Matt's are because he likes feeding cows, then straw's okay. So long as we get that ration right for the dry cow. If they're looking a bit thin, then straw probably isn't okay.
We actually fed a lot of hay and straw 2 years ago on another farm down mid Wales. Cows were absolutely fat as pigs. They were so overweight. So we thought, right, then we'll feed them some hay and straw because it'll take it off them. They actually came in the sheds very, very heavy. So we thought we'd try and take a little bit off them. So we fed hay and straw. And that was the biggest learning curve I've had so far in farming, because what actually happened is they ended up with fatty livers because we took it off them too quickly, and it can happen really quickly. And I was never even aware of this, you know. And all of a sudden you've got cows that going from looking amazing and overweight to dead within 24 hours. It's frightening. So I just wanted to put that in there because that's quite a high risk element, where how to take that condition off cows if they are that sort of over conditioned coming in off a really good season grazed grass. And yeah,
the time to change conditions gore in your cows is before you dry them off. We should really only be changing by a quarter to half a condition score during the dry cow period, otherwise you end up with those sorts of situations. So it's trying to monitor those before drying off to reduce conditions if they become over-conditioned. And it is a challenge, but it's a very important thing that we try and home in on.
To be fair, Matt, that wasn't necessarily the fault of the straw feeding that caused you problems with your fatty livers. It was the fact that the cows were over-conditioned in the first place, and you trying to bring them back in line caused a fatty liver problem. Straw feeding can be quite successful as long as it's a balanced ration to meet the needs of the cow. But I know from where you farm, you know, the cost of straw is something you do really have to consider, whether that's a viable thing.
Yeah, agreed. I was more putting that in there for other people that might be thinking this winter, my cows are too fat, and maybe they've got hay and straw in the sheds, and everybody's doing stuff different this year. Everybody's starting to change what they're doing. If they've got straw or hay that's cheap in the shed now, they might think at the back end, I'm going to look after my good quality feed and I'm going to feed a bit too much of something too late on. That's what happened to us, you know. So it's more to the fact of just telling the story.
Yeah, good. Thank you, Matt. Yeah.
Just on the hay versus straw, hay will not cause that massive reduction in body condition. Straw will, because hay is still quite nutritious if it's well made.
Well, we were probably feeding 12 bales of hay versus one bale of straw, to be honest, Dave. And I don't know, maybe it was really poor quality hay, it was cheap hay. But I've never gone through that before, and I never will again.
Expensive learning.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good. So is there anything else, Matt, that you would like to get from what we're discussing, you know, particular to your farm and in your system? And is there any other key points or guidance that you could extract from Dave while we got him here?
I think it's varieties, like grass varieties and stuff like that. If you've got ground that's available to you all year, and what sort of grass varieties and stuff like that we should be using to maximise quality and the amount of cuts that we get. You know, typically as a spring carver, my personal thoughts are that we're not very good at making top quality silage, because we focus on grazing grass, utilising grass and walking cows to it rather than carrying it to them. I certainly am like that. And I don't particularly like milking cows inside. That's why I run the system I run. And I want my Christmas with not milking cows. And that's the honest truth on that. So I'm not very good at the right type of grass varieties, and every rep will tell you that their grass varieties are the best, and I don't know any different.
I think the key point there is to use the independent data that is now part of the levy body responsibility sponsored lists that are independently verified through growing trials undertaken by NIAB. And each year they publish that list. And I think it's taking varieties from that list that is ideal, with a key target is yield. I think if you've got areas that you're taking on that will be silage lays, I think you should be looking at the silage aspects more than the grazing aspects. Having said all that, the key thing, which is lost a little bit in the list, you might pick a variety that's got claimed to have, you know, a yield of a few hundred kilos more per hectare. It's top of the list, and it's got a D value that's at the time those trials are cut is 75D. Versus one that's 74D. And the biggest difference when you come to cut your silage is actually your timing. So the grass variety has very little impact on that. So it's really looking at what fits in your system, how long you've got that ground, how long that sward's going to survive. So if you've got the ground for 2 or 3 years, then, you know, an Italian or a hybrid is going to give you the biggest yield over that time. If you've got that opportunity for 2 or 3 years, if you've got the land for 5, 6, 7 years, then a perennial. But it's always looking at those lists because they are independent, and taking your judgment from those lists. Just coming back to the seed reps, the organisations that are not linked into one seed house can often give you a better mix because they can select from different seed houses. And if they're doing a good job, they should be selecting the best from the best. But it's always looking back at the AHDB HCC list to see what is where on that list and choosing those from that list.
A good point. Thank you, Dave. And we can make sure that that's available. Matt, if you've not already got a copy of it, there's the recommended list for grasses and so on, that very useful independent information. As well as that, so Dave, is there anything else that you feel that we haven't covered which you think is worth a mention?
I think we've covered a lot today, and there's been some very interesting discussions about silage management at feed out and how that fits into a farm system. All I'd like to say at the end of this is, please, everybody out there that's making silage this year, focus on the nutritive requirements from that silage that your stock have. And if that means a little extra hassle by making two completely different types of silage, it will pay back, specifically in a year where we do not know what the cost of anything coming onto that farm is going to be.
Okay, good.
It's been fascinating to learn how Matt has been planning his silage for his dry cows. You can find more tools and resources to help you learn more about silage by visiting our grass webpage at ahdb.org.uk/grass. You can also follow Matt's strategic farm journey by searching for Penlech Back on the HDB website. Thanks for listening.
If you have any comments about this podcast, or have ideas for future episodes, please email foodandfarming@ahdb.org.uk.